Okay, called order this meeting of the House Transportation and Economic Development Committee. It is Wednesday, February 8th. Welcome, everybody. Just to give you a sense of where we're heading this morning, we've got, I think, a couple of members in the room. I'm only seeing one now, but I thought there was a...
We'll be back.
Okay. So I think we're going to take up first House Bill 4129, and then go to House Bill 4150, and then go to House Bill 4031, and then go to 4040 or 4028. We'll see. We're going to be awaiting a fiscal and revenue impact statement on 4040, so we'll do those two last. So let's begin by opening up a public hearing on House Bill 4129. Invite Representative Doherty forward, and Patrick, please brief us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4129 repeals a requirement from the Jobs and Transportation Act, House Bill 2001, for the Department of Transportation to conduct a pilot project for entering into a contract for private maintenance of a segment of state highway. We have received the no fiscal, no revenue impact statement on the measure. There's no amendment, and it has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage, Mr. Chair.
That's right. Okay. If you want to bring someone else with you, feel free. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs. Members of the committee, I'm Representative Margaret Doherty. I represent House District 35, which is Greater Tigard, King City, and Southwest Portland. We're here this morning also to members of SEIU who work in the Highway Division. I'm here this morning to give testimony on House Bill 4129, and it's actually a fairly simple bill. It's a bill that gives ODOT the ability to end an experiment if the experiment is too expensive. Back in a little bit of background to it is that as part of the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act, the legislature decided to conduct an experiment, and it created a program with the aim of saving money by outsourcing the highway maintenance to a private company, and the project is to last 6 years. We know that everyone in the building, especially in this time, talks about government efficiency and saving taxpayers money and prioritizing services to ensure that critical programs are preserved. And what you have before you is a bill today that does exactly that, and it does it in the most flexible and simple way possible. As I said, as part of the 2009 jobs bill, it created a section of highway that would be privatized. And the section of highway is the 26th section between Shoals in Washington County. It goes up over Chehalem Mountain and then ends up in Yamhill County and over to Marion County. And if you've ever driven that highway, it's kind of a little high, and it's a very curvy highway. But what we do is we fast forward 3 years, and the result of the mandate is an expensive project on Highway 219 in Washington County and Yamhill County. In the first year, the project is projected to cost more than three times as much as it would if it would be under the Oregon Department of Transportation to maintain that highway. It is expected to cost $698,000 for the private contractor versus $200,000 in ODOT for the 26-mile stretch of highway. This mandate also had ODOT to provide training for the contractor, taking up more time and money that could have been better spent maintaining roads and servicing the people of Oregon. A list of the trainings that were provided by ODOT are included in the ODOT report, which you have with my testimony. But it includes things that ODOT also was going to be responsible for, and they pay the electric bill and if they have any sort of projects that deal with that. But I think one important thing needs to be made with this is that the bill does not end the project. And I repeat then, the bill does not end the project. What it just does is give ODOT the ability to end the project if it is too costly of an experiment. And I also want to make it very clear that the contractor's been doing a very good job. And I think the ODOT report went through and talked about the kinds of things that they did on Chehalem Mountain and what they've been doing on that 26-mile stretch. So they've been doing a good job. The one thing about mandates, and any of us who have been in the building more than 24 hours knows that we create mandates, and many times we do not fund these mandates. So what this bill is, it turns a mandate into a permissive item that gives ODOT the ability to end the project. And you never know whether the contractor also may want to end the project because they will not be able to meet the terms, or it would not be cost effective for them to continue. So what we're asking you to do is to support House Bill 4129. It's good for the people of Oregon. It saves money. It shows all of our constituents that we're prudent with the kind of funds that we have, and that we could possibly have another $500,000 going back to road projects. So I also have two members of the Highway Division to testify and answer questions.
Great. If you're able to stay there, we'll we'll go to them and then come back for questions for any of the three of you.
Okay.
Morning.
Good morning. Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Vince and the members of the committee. My name is Katie Cronlin-Hubler, and I've been with the Oregon Department of Transportation for almost 10 years. I'm also a member of SEIU Local 503, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 4129. The representative already went over the background, and so I'll skip ahead to some highlights. The initial bid came in at $1.2 million to maintain this stretch of highway for 1 year. And it was recognized that part of the cost that they were reflecting was the cost of equipment that they didn't own, and things that they weren't sure how much the cost would be, and so it was added in as contingency money. And they did get it down to the $700,000 for the first year of maintaining this highway, with a lot of hours of ODOT time training them, also leasing equipment to them because they didn't own the equipment, and also allowing them to use ODOT property to work out of. And I read the review, the report after the initial first year, and it does cost considerably more for that same stretch of highway than it would for the ODOT crews to do the same work. And but what I kind of wanted to go over, I actually am a procurement officer for the state of Oregon, and so from my standpoint and as a citizen, the six-year stretch that they put on it to begin with is a fairly long contract for a pilot project that is very much an experiment. And I'm in support of this bill because it doesn't end the contract. What it does is allow it flexibility so that if things are not going well and they continue to not go well, the funding can, you know, be maintained for highway maintenance instead of continuing to pour money into something that is not going well, but we're locked in for 6 years at least. I don't think that it's prudent and responsible use of state funds to pay more than three times the cost that it would for state employees to do the job. But I do want to note that both the legislature and ODOT have made a really good faith effort in this, and I do understand what the positive parts of the concept were. And you know, it's something that was kind of a fact-finding experiment, and I think that at this point, it would be good to have more flexibility to be able to cut the losses and move forward and use that money for other things, like the additional lane miles that could be maintained, especially at this point where ODOT is just beginning to have to reassess what level of maintenance and repair they can afford to do with the reduced budget that's available for many reasons. It would be better and in the best interest of the state of Oregon to spend that money actually maintaining the roads in the most cost-effective way possible.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, and members of the committee, my name is Glenn Smith. I'm an employee with Oregon Department of Transportation. I work in the Portland metropolitan area. I'm a member of the SEIU Local 503, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 4129. As previously mentioned, the inefficient use of state resources is one of the biggest concerns with this pilot project, And what I'd like to do is highlight what we are getting for the cost and what we are not. Again, as it's already stated, the original bid for the Highway 219 was $1.2 million. And they were held to a budget of $700,000. The Highway 219 is 26 miles of highway, or as commonly referred to in the industry, 52 lane miles. Our budget, where I work, is roughly $1.3 million. We staff 11 and a half employees and cover over 61 miles of highway, or roughly 300 lane miles, because we have multiple lanes, secondary roads, and overpasses. And that's rather soft because they didn't really include overpasses and other parts of our highway. The pilot program is very rural with open ditches and very few features. We, where I work, have 30 plus overpasses, miles of guardrail and GM barrier, and well over 400 drains to maintain that we clean out every season. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 800, but I wanted to give you an idea of what we do. We maintain all of this for just a little over the submitted bid of the pilot program. Comparatively speaking, $700,000 at 52 lane miles would be $3.5 million for 260 lane miles. Or if you looked at the original bid of 1.2, that would equate to $6 million for the 260 lane miles. And of course, that's considering that bid was on a rural highway with very few features. Please realize the piece of highway selected for the pilot program is rural, as I mentioned. And then, of course, as you increase features to be maintained, cost goes up with that because there's many more things to take care of. In closing, I'd like to point out that the pilot project is costing roughly $13,450 a lane mile. Again, that's a very rural, simple highway. It's currently costing us, in my department, well under $5,000 a lane mile, and that's with all the additional features it takes to support a metropolitan area. And with that, I'll close. And again, thank you for your time.
Thank you all. And colleagues, we do still have Senator Starr and Paul Mather from ODOT still coming. But so with that in mind, questions for these first three witnesses?
Representative Lindsay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I'm just reading the very first page of the ODOT report. But who did the negotiating with the contractor? And whoever did that negotiating, did they consider hiring someone that was trained and that did have the equipment?
To train them?
Yeah, the statement was is that part of the cost,
right,
the additional cost, was because the contractor needed to be trained because the contractor did not have the equipment. And my question is whoever negotiated that contract with the private contractor, did they not consider hiring someone that did have the equipment and that was trained?
I can't answer that question. I was not in the negotiations.
I can add that they do have quite a bit of equipment. They're obviously in the road maintenance. They're in the business. But there was some additional equipment that was provided to them from ODOT. And it's my understanding that equipment, that they can use that also on other jobs that they're working as well. But I think specialty stuff, de-icers, sanders, plows, that kind of equipment was supplied.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you held them to a budget of $700,000, knowing that it costs you $200,000 to do this. Why didn't you find somebody that was more comparable to what it costs you?
We're actually not the contracting people. That would be a question of.
I understand you, but you're ODOT.
Right, but we aren't a part of this contract. We're here as basically citizens saying, you know, we're supporting this bill because this is clearly not going the right direction. What I would venture to guess is that it was a mandate to to do this, and they did it at the least cost possible. And in my experience, there's not a whole lot of private contractors who do de-icing and snow plowing of highways and maintain highways, because even the city has their own and the county has their own staff that do that. So I'm not sure how
I apologize. I didn't realize that you were here as citizens and not representing ODOT, so I'll withdraw my question and ask that later.
Yeah, and Paul Mather from ODOT has signed up to speak. That's a good question that I'm sure either he can address or we get somebody else from ODOT.
Because we can get that answer for you, because usually with any sort of thing like this, especially when you're trying a brand new experiment that has not been done before, there are certain, like any business, cost up front that the private vendor needs to go through and deal with that they don't have before. And that was a huge part of what the initial bid was for them to go out and purchase equipment to do the job that ODOT had been doing on that stretch of highway.
Thank you.
Coach Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would be curious that when, in your opinion, we would know if things aren't going well. Because I think the way it was explained a few minutes ago in your testimony, you wanted to give ODOT the flexibility to terminate the program if things weren't going well. Do you think they know enough as of this very moment to make that determination? Or, in your opinion, do they need to go another year or so? When do you think they should make this decision? What should they base it on?
As I understand the question, the way that the bill is that they are supposed to have that experiment for 6 years, kind of no matter what, is from what I understand with the original bill, without that flexibility of being able to get out of the contract or to go through and renegotiate terms and all of that kind of thing. And so I think that's the main purpose of what this bill is to not be able to go through and say, okay, we've got an experiment in very lean times in the state of Oregon. Should it be an experiment we continue, or should it be an experiment that we don't, just because it's too costly?
What's your best?
Hello. I'm sorry. The way I had it was explained by our two citizen ODOT employees is that they wanted or assumed this bill would provide flexibility so that if ODOT determined, quote, that things aren't going well, they could terminate it. So my question is, when should that determination be made? Things aren't going well. What standard is that? And what would you ask that we direct ODOT to do? You know, and is the measure that which we are hearing about, the spread in the cost, or is the measure the quality of the work, or what's not going well mean?
To me, in my opinion, the pilot is not going well already, but the purpose of this bill is to allow it to end prematurely. While the mandate stated that it has to go for 6 years, and the contract was written up in a way that I have never actually seen a public contract, in that there is no termination clause other than if both parties agree. Mm-hmm. And I personally think that was a mistake to begin with, because there should always be a way to terminate if it's not going well for either party. Because clearly, if the contractor, if they want to continue doing it and getting paid to do it, they may not agree to terminate the contract. I don't know a whole lot about politics, but I'm under the impression that a bill to simply terminate this contract would cause legal problems because of the way the contract is written. What we need to do is take steps towards being allowed to terminate the contract. And if that clarifies a little bit.
Thank you.
Any Representative Lindsay?
Just one quick question. If you don't know the answer, maybe someone else can answer it that will be testifying. And that is, Representative Doherty said that most of the cost was the upfront cost. Mm-hmm. And so my question would be then, now that the upfront cost is out of the way, would it not be a better measure of the true costs by measuring what happened after the upfront cost, especially since this report was May 2011? Would it not be better to have another report from May 2011 to May 2012 that shows the actual expenses after the upfront cost?
Well, if I can clarify, the initial bid was $1.3 million, and that included the equipment that they wanted to purchase. The state of Oregon said, no, we're not going to purchase the equipment. You can lease the equipment from us, and then the bid went down to $698,000. So they did not purchase the equipment. They leased it from the state of Oregon, but the initial bid was for $1.3 million, which included purchase of equipment.
So if I might follow up on that, I think on the same track where Representative Lindsay's going, so of the $698,000 bid, we're not anticipating that that's going to drop, because that doesn't really include, that's just the work. That's not any upfront costs within the $698,000, right?
Yes, the $698,000 was for the work. It was not for any of the upfront costs. The $1.3 million, from what we understand, would have included equipment. So the $698,000 was versus the $200,000 that the state usually spends for this 26-mile stretch of highway was for work performed.
Co-Chair Hunt, may I add something related to Representative Lindsay's question? As an employee of the state, I can tell you that our max hourly rate does not meet the minimum prevailing rate that are paid to the private sector. For example, if they are operating a truck, I think the rate is roughly $28 an hour. If they happen to get an excavator and do some ditch work, now they're getting paid, I think it's $45 an hour. So as a state employee, that's a little bit of a sting. You know, on top of that, taking furloughs and everything else that comes along with that, to see somebody operating doing the very same thing for more than twice the hourly rate. So I don't see that going away.
Okay. We appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Wagner.
That's okay. Thank you. This probably could be more for Representative Doherty, but do we know how many bids were put for this 26-mile stretch road? Is it just one company? Was there three? Was there five?
Well, I did a little bit of research on it, and I believe there were three, and two of them were turned down, and then we ended up with the folks that are taking care of it now.
And we'll make sure that Paul Mather from ODOT addresses that when he comes up, too. That's a good question. Thank you, Representative Doherty, for bringing this forward, and I really appreciate, I think the only way we're going to effectively be able to cut budgets and find economies of scale is, frankly, having the active engagement of workers across the state, because we're not out there deeply embedded in the agencies to know where there are a lot of those economies of scale and savings to be found, so really appreciate you all helping us by identifying areas like these and others.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. And I do have to compliment one of our people who testified, just got off work, and he's been working all night. So I thought that, you didn't realize that, but thank you for your questions that were not super detailed, because I'm not quite sure. He's quite still awake yet.
Yeah, so. It's been rough.
All right, good. Thank you all very much. Let's invite Senator Starr to come up. Welcome to the upper chamber. Good to have you here.
Good to be back. For the record, I'm State Senator Bruce Starr, representing Western Washington County in the Oregon Senate. I'm here to testify on House Bill 4129. This particular pilot project was one that was negotiated on a bipartisan basis. A group of Republicans, Democrats, House members, Senate members worked together to put into what was House Bill 2009, I believe. 2001 in 2009.
Exactly.
There we go. And I can understand the angst, particularly from the Public Employees Union and SEIU opposing this particular pilot program. I would suggest that it's a little too early at this point to call it a complete and utter failure and to pull the plug on it. We did, last session, actually pass legislation to pull the plug on another pilot program that we had undertook in the city of Portland because it was quite clear that particular pilot was not moving forward in a constructive fashion. The frustration that I have with this particular program at this point is, and it's a frustration I think that we look at when we outsource to the private sector, public sector work, and you just heard it from the previous testifiers about having to pay above market wage, or what is the market wage And being able to compare apples to apples, I think, is a difficult thing. I would urge the committee to not pass this bill today. I think it is absolutely appropriate for us to continue to monitor and watch and closely look at this particular pilot program as we move forward. I would suggest that in my study of this particular initiative across other states, their experience has been much different than what we see currently operating here in this particular pilot. We see states where significant dollars have been saved by moving vast majority of their maintenance work from the public sector to the private sector. Honestly, I'd have to dig into the ODOT numbers to a significant greater degree than I've had the opportunity so far to know what totally is behind, you know, if they look at their four-year average, you know, what is all included in those numbers to see if we are actually comparing apples to apples. I think that's something that we can do in the next few months, not in this particular short session, not in this particular condensed time period that we're under right now. I'd also suggest that there are a number of negotiated parts that were in the Jobs and Transportation Act that weren't necessarily loved by members of the conservative Republican branch of the body, but were agreed to be in the bill. This is kind of the flip side of that coin, and I would suggest that we not move this bill. Let's watch this as we move forward. And I'm, for one, going to dig into the numbers significantly more than I have today. I quite honestly hadn't looked at this pilot, hadn't had any reports in front of me until today, and look forward to digging into the numbers and really understanding what all the underlying costs on the public sector are, so we can get a true apples-to-apples comparison. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I appreciate the folks bringing the bill forward. I look forward to continuing to look closely at this particular issue. Nobody, I'm sure, behind the dais there or sitting here is interested in quote-unquote wasting taxpayers' dollars, that's for sure. So let's make sure we can dig deep and understand the data and understand the numbers. But at this point, I would ask that you not move the bill forward. Let's continue to look at it. The beauty of being in the building every year is we have an opportunity to look at it again next January. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to testify and appreciate your attention.
Questions? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought Co-Chair Bentz asked a good question at our last panel, and I'd be interested in your thoughts, too. I remember I'm not probably going to do a very good job of summarizing his question, but in essence, the way I took his question was, what should be the standard, and asking for thoughts on what the sort of definition of it's not going well might be. And as a person who was involved in the construction of the underlying legislation, I'm interested in what you think about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. Ultimately, the goal is to save taxpayers' dollars, and if ultimately it doesn't do that, I think that would be the standard by which I'd be interested in looking forward. Again, for me, I need to, I intend to dig deeper into, the ODOT has, a four-year assumed cost. What's in those numbers, and if we can get to a apples to apples comparison, that's what I would like to do. And I, at this point, haven't had the opportunity to do that. I have my own thoughts too about how perhaps the department has handled the negotiation. I'm getting kind of to Representative Lindsay's question, but ultimately, nobody's interested in wasting money. And so if it proves out that, this is not a good investment of the taxpayers' dollars, I'm sitting before you a year from now and be happy to recommend, just like we did in Portland, that we have a failed experiment or we don't. But at this point, I'm not ready to make that call.
Thank you. Representative Weider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming over on this, Senator. I think when we dig into this, one of the things we want to do is look at how much does it cost when ODOT sands, how much does it cost when the private company sands, and break it down, because sometimes in these contracts we put unfair burdens on somebody else that we don't normally do ourselves because we were too lazy to do it, but now I got somebody else in here, so I'm going to make them do what I didn't want to do, some things like that. So I think we need to, when we start looking at this, break it out on every little detail to see what might make the cost a little higher, a little less. So,
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Widener, I agree. We have examples all over the country where DOTs have utilized the private sector in a way that has saved their taxpayers' dollars. I'm interested in, you know, comparing what makes Oregon so different that, you know, only public sector folks, you know, for whatever reason, can do these jobs at a less cost, I guess. So it's an apples to apples kind of comparison. Let's look at, you know, what makes ODOT different from, you know, the other DOTs from around the country. And ultimately, though, the goal is to conserve, you know, precious taxpayers' dollars.
Co-Chair Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you answered it, but we will have an opportunity in a few minutes to ask ODOT some of the questions about this that will move us toward that understanding. Do you have some suggestions of lines of inquiry? I think you just gave them to us, but if you have some additional ones,
I think that some of the conversations about wage costs, you know, what do they roll in, total wages would be a question. When you look at the equipment that's necessary, those are issues you need to compare. I'm going to compare Oregon's overall prevailing wage costs to other states and see if that ultimately is the reason why this is outside of the, you know, what I would hope that the results would have been. So those are things that I'm certainly going to look at.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So just one other question. In terms of, I think you were probably as surprised as I was in terms of seeing the numbers coming back. Maybe talk a little bit more about what you see as the downside. I understand your concern about saying to ODOT, rescind the contract. If we pass something saying rescind the contract, stop the pilot, talk a little bit about what you see as the downside of saying to ODOT, if this trend continues between, you know, basically in the next, functionally it's going to be another 15 to 16 months before we're going to be back here and actually able to pass a bill that's going to go into law. If in the next 2 months or 5 months or 12 months this trend is continuing, it's clearly costing, to use your standard, clearly costing taxpayers more money to do the same work, what would be the downside of saying to ODOT, you are empowered to save taxpayer money if this is heading down the same road, as opposed to the current bill, which is saying you've got to stay on the road regardless if it costs more or if it costs less?
So the downside is, quite honestly, that I personally haven't dug into the numbers enough to be comfortable with the report to understand exactly, you know, what goes into each side of the equation. So that's number one. Number two, we will be back here next year. ODOT is under contract, I believe, with the entity, I believe, for a 6-year period of time. So Mr. Matthews can talk about that. So at this point, if I would support not moving this bill forward. The legislature will be back. In the meantime, for me personally, I'll be able to dig deeper into these numbers and get a sense of what it is that we're comparing here to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming over. Paul Mather. Please come forward. You've got a list of questions that have already been articulated for you before your arrival. And that's why you brought backup this morning, right? Smart man.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. With me today also is Vivian Payne. Vivian is our Regional Operation and Maintenance Manager for the Northwest Oregon. So I'll save the tougher questions for her. I want to just quickly go through my testimony. I think much of what you've heard today gives you some of the background, but I wanted to give you a few highlights of the background. I'm not going to go through my full testimony that you have in front of you, but I'll cover some of the major highlights. As been pointed out to you, in the Jobs and Transportation Act in 2009, this was one of the many different things that were in that bill that created the Jobs and Transportation Act. It required us for 6 years to do a pilot for contracting out maintenance on a 10 to 30 mile section of highway. We went through a process to select this section, and what we did, we looked at a section of highway that covered a variety of different things that we do in maintenance. So it wasn't just, say, a mountain pass or just a section of freeway. We wanted something that covered the variety of things from electrical maintenance, signal maintenance, to signs, to had some snow plowing that was involved. But to give a true picture of that, in this section, if you look at the very back page of my testimony, it gives you a map of where this section of highway is. But it runs from Woodburn through Newburgh on up to Shoals. So it has a mixture of rural as well as some urban features that are in Newburgh and on the outskirts of Woodburn to give us some picture. One of the other criteria we looked at in selecting this section is we wanted to be near where contractors were. We didn't want to pick a section of highway that was so remote it was going to be even more of a burden on contractors or limit the competition for the work by being too rural. So we wanted to pick a section that was available closely for contractors to compete with. So those are just some of the highlights of some of the backgrounds. I'm going to skip ahead maybe to where we are today. As you've heard, the contractor is generally doing a good job. We're pleased with the work that's been going on for the first year. It's definitely been what I would describe as a learning curve for both the contractor and for us. This is something new for ODOT to manage this type of contract, and certainly new work for the contractor. Building highways and maintaining highways are actually very different work to do. And I think as we administer this contract, we're becoming more fully aware of that, and I think as well as the contractor. But as we've gone through this year, we've seen us both learn and kind of grow with that. When we went with the contract, we sent out a request for information, and we had 25 attendees representing 35 different firms of 10 that. We had letters of interest from 13 different firms, and when we actually came down to proposals, there was 3 different firms that actually proposed on our contract. Most of these, or all of these contractors, are not in the business of highway maintenance. They're in the business of highway construction, and so for any of these, it was going to be a transition from, again, highway construction to highway maintenance, and there's many things that we do in highway maintenance different than construction. Plowing snow is probably the most obvious one of that. As a highway contractor and building highways, you don't have the equipment to plow snow, use de-icers, many of the things that we do in highway maintenance. As we work through the contract, our original proposal or thought was to do a lump sum contract and a performance-based contract, but as we work through the different risk areas, we quickly understood that, again, in our learning curve where we were and where the contractor was, there wasn't enough information on either side to negotiate a contract that was fully a performance-based contract and move to a time and material-based contract. As we move through the 6-year contract that we did sign, are anticipating that we do move back to a performance-based contract and away from a time and material based contract, but we don't have enough experience, again, on either side to come up with that level of contracts yet.
Some of the things that we did to reduce costs, when we first saw the costs that come in that were considerably higher than we anticipated, and began to understand some of the things that were driving those costs. One of the major issues was incident response. So again, we have an accident that happens or some incident that happens on the highway. We're set up with a dispatch center, with road patrols that are out there patrolling the highways and able to respond fairly quickly. Obviously, the contractor doesn't have that type of infrastructure in place to perform those kind of tasks. So that's one of the functions that we kept, just from the scale of this size of contract, that it seemed to make more sense for us to do. I mentioned some of the specific specialized pieces of equipment that we have for some of those things that are unique to highway maintenance, like snow plowing. So some of those pieces of equipment, rather than requiring the contractor to buy new equipment for snow plows, we leased the equipment that we had to the contractor and included those costs that we leased them in the costs for the contracts. So those are some of the highlights of some of the things that we've done to reduce the cost. One more time, I'll mention is material cost is another thing. De-icer is an example of that. Sanding rock, again, typically as a contractor, you don't have those type of things on hand. We have large quantity of those things on hand and buy those in large bulk. And so we included those as well, available to the contractor at a cost. So if you look at the cost that we've been talking about, we are estimating our cost to be roughly $247,000 in the first year. That includes some overhead factors that we've tried to include above and beyond the true cost. Of our cost for a three-year period, we've added a cost, overhead cost, to our cost. And we compare that to what the contractor's costs are, which are what you've heard already, the $698,000 is what our costs of our payments have been to the contractor. Breaking those costs down from the contractor's cost, $247,000allowance for contract administration and overhead costs, and $451,000 for performance of work. Turning to the bill itself, as you've talked about already, the bill would repeal the requirement for us to contract out this work, but we have a six-year contract that we have signed with the contractor. Our intent would be to continue that contract as we go through this learning curve. Obviously, 1 year worth of work gives us some information, but we need more. We've also made a significant investment going through this contract process and setting all this up. This is a question that's been before the legislature for a number of years. I know as a young engineer with ODOT, and I was thinking this morning, I think it was the 87 or and the 89 session, I was actually in front of this committee talking about studies we were doing to contract out maintenance. So it's been a topic that's been in front of this body for a number of years and likely will be in the future. And I think the more data we can gather from the investment we've already made in this contract will be valuable for future conversations about contracting out maintenance. So our intent would be, even at the with the bill, that we would continue to the contract for at least the next several years to gather more information about the costs on both sides. One of the questions that was asked is some of the criteria we would use to come to a decision. Again, this is a pilot project. One of the things I would want is that we'd be continually learning, again, on both sides, for the contractor and for us. And as long as we continue to be learning and improving, that would be one of the things I would be looking for, rather than just maybe bottom line costs, that we, again, view this as a pilot and view this as an experience we can all learn from to educate ourselves for future conversations about contracting out maintenance work. I guess just in summary, we're very pleased with the contractor. Eagle Elsner was a successful contractor. They've had a great attitude in working with us and learning when we've pointed out things that needed to be fixed or repaired. They've approached that in a very positive way in working with us. It's been a good relationship the first year, and we look forward to that relationship to continue to grow and improve. With that, we'll take questions.
Question, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, on the one hand, I'm glad to hear comments that there's a positive working relationship. On the other hand, when I look at these numbers, it's startling. It's just startling. From 873,000 to over 1 million annually, compared to an ODOT four-year average of less than a quarter of a million. So that's a startling difference in a cost paragraph. I guess there's one thing in particular I want to be sure I understand. I fear that I don't understand it right now. I would like clarification. On page 3 of the document, toward the bottom is a section on costs is most of that page. Toward the bottom, where the word contractor is underlined, we have a paragraph on contract payments. $451,500 was for work performed. $247,000 is allowance for administrative and overhead costs. That seems like a really big ratio of administrative and overhead costs to work performed. I'd really like to understand more about what that's about, particularly given that in the third point below that, it mentions the markup rates. So I think what those markup rates mean that if they can demonstrate the labor costs, I'm just going to pick a number to make it simple. If they had a labor cost on something of $100, that means what they paid somebody, they would have a markup rate of 20% on top of that. Is that what that means? And if they paid $100 for material, let's say for equipment, either purchase or lease, they, on top of their true cost, they'd put 17% on top of that. So are those markup rates in addition to the $247,000 allowance, or is that just telling me what's comprising that allowance?
Chairman and committee members, that is in addition to.
Can you just introduce?
Oh, I'm sorry. Vivian Payne, ODOT Region Operations and Maintenance Manager for Region 2.
That's in addition to the $247,000 allowance.
That's correct.
Further questions?
No, that's.
Those numbers match up.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Nathanson, what we used in guiding ourselves through building this contract was our standard contracting method that we use for our other highway construction and highway design contracts. And this, maybe the way we've laid it out here hasn't been as clear as we could have been, but it's the standard way that we do our contracts with highway construction and with our highway design contracts.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, Paul, was there a plan ODOT put together as it received the 2001 direction and then it moved to implement this new approach to highway maintenance? Was there a, where would we see what the plan was? I mean, here's an instruction from a two or three lines in a statute. What then was done when it comes to trying to make sure that this pilot project followed a designed, pre-thought-through plan? And where would we see that?
Co-Chair Bentz, one of the things that we're required to do in the bill is to provide the legislature with reports every 2 years on this project. And last May, we submitted one of those reports. And as we learn more, as we go through this, you'll see in those reports the outcomes of this. As far as our plan was relatively simple: comply with what was in the Jobs and Transportation Act, pick a section of highway that gave us as fair a comparison as we could come up with between contractor work and our work, and that's how we set the contract up. Beyond that, there wasn't a broader plan other than to come up with as fair a comparison as we could construct by picking a section of highway, picking it in a location that offered competition, so forth.
What's your bets?
Thank you. Okay, so as fair as a comparison as you could, that would mean that in this apples-to-apples standard reflected in Senator Starr's remarks, you would have a baseline against which to measure the outcomes. Have we seen that baseline and the components of it? The elements of the baseline, this $200,000 that I'm hearing, I have not seen what it consists of. Where would I find that?
Co-Chair Bentz, that $200,000 represents a three-four-year average of our cost in that same section of highway. If by applying an overhead rate on top of that, we've come up with, I believe it's the roughly $250,000 comparisons, trying to get to an apple to apples. I think as we keep going in this study and we produce further reports and eventually a final report with some conclusions, we'll dig more into appropriate overhead rates on our side, as well as understand some of the prevailing wage issues or other issues that may be driving costs on either side. We're just getting into this study and aren't prepared to draw any conclusions from what we have so far.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's difficult for me to understand how this could progress without having that baseline already established, particularly the overhead element of it, that is, the administration element of it, all the other elements that go with the cost. Let me ask this question slightly backwards. How much money has the department saved as a result of not having to do the maintenance?
Co-Chair Bentz, the overall costs so far have been more. We haven't included in our number of $247,000 the administration costs of the contract. It's been just what offsets what we would have done, as you point out in your question, what we would have done on the highway versus what we've paid the contractor to do on the highway for maintenance work. We haven't included in those apples-to-apples comparisons what our costs are to administer that contract. Again, we're on a learning curve, and what is it going to take for us to administer the contract? I think the first year, my guess is it's going to be much higher for us to understand how much work we have to do to administer this contract. As we understand more, I would anticipate those contract administration costs to go down.
Hold on, please. And my question was, how much money have we saved as a result of not having to do the maintenance? Do we have that number? Because we wouldn't have been putting our trucks out there.
Coach, it was that roughly $250,000 number we've been talking about.
Follow up. Okay, I would very much like to see those numbers and how we got to them.
Okay.
And I've asked for them previously. I haven't seen them. I didn't ask you for them. But we need to see them, and I also need to see the plan that's going to achieve the desired outcome, which was a clear understanding of this changed method of doing this type of work. And I'm just, having not seen it, I'm not really in a position to criticize it. I just need to see it. So I look forward to that.
We'll follow up with you with that.
And I think those would be helpful for all the committee. And presumably that's numbers you've got. I think Coach Bentz is basically just asking you to show your work. I think you've already done that work. It's just a matter of if you'd just share with us. I think that'd be really useful. Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Paul. There are a couple things that I'd like to see if you still have them. There's an implementation plan that's mentioned in one of the documents from May 28th, 2010 that the contractor put out. I think I'd like to see a copy of that, and also just looking at the number of the requests for information that went out, the 13, because you had 35 of those, you got 13 letters back and only three responded. I think I'd like to see the request for information as well, and just see what's been asked of the contractors, why so few put in, and why those numbers were so far out of whack from what was expected. I'd just like to see what was asked, I think, there.
We'll follow up with that.
Thank you.
The you may have said it, or maybe in your document, I'm not finding it. Did you say the contract you entered into with the contractor, is it some kind of a yearly renewable contract, or is it a mandatory 6 years where you're already stuck regardless of what bill we pass?
Co-Chair Hunt, we've signed a six-year contract, and in that six-year contract, so far it's been set up in increments of a year to do a time and material contract. The intent is, again, eventually to transition into a performance-based contract to fill out the life of the six-year contract. So we have signed a six-year contract.
So is there anything in that, if the costs continue with the current kind of gap of what their costs would be versus what your costs would be to do the same work, if that continues into year two and year three and year four, do you have any mechanism within that contract? I'm just saying, if we did pass this legislation, would you have a mechanism in that contract to be able to break it, get out of it, do it more cheaply?
Co-Chair Hunt, there are specific avenues for us to get out of the contract. As I understand it, cost alone is not one of those. There would have to meet other criteria as well to not proceed with the contract. So just because costs may be different wouldn't be reason enough alone for us to walk away from the contract without consequences on our part. Mm. So we would be judging those consequences versus what is that cost gap that we are seeing.
Well, I almost feel like I want to apologize. As one of the negotiators on the package, I almost feel like I want to apologize for putting this particular turd in ODOT's pocket, because the whole discussion around this contract was how much money might we be able to save and could they do the job up to the same standards. I don't think we spent 1 second discussing what might happen if it costs a lot more to do this work than is currently being spent. So unfortunately the language was written in a way that didn't anticipate what has apparently become the outcome. So my apologies. Any further questions? Thank you both for coming forward.
Thank you.
So we're going to, that's all the folks we have signed up to testify now. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4129 and open the public hearing on House Bill 4150. We have just three folks to testify on this, and then we'll be moving on to House Bill 4031. So I invite Representative Holvey, and actually, why don't we have all three folks come forward. Representative Holvey, Larry, and John, and Patrick, please brief us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4150 expands the definition of qualified businesses eligible for credit guarantees from the Credit Enhancement Fund to include non-traded sector businesses. The measure has a sunset date of July 1st, 2015, an emergency clause that would take effect upon passage. We have in your packet the Dash 1 Amendment. I believe the Dash 1 Amendment may be addressed by some of the folks we have up here. It fixes a drafting error. So that amendment, Ledge Council informs us, will be needed for the bill. But we have not, at this point, received the fiscal and revenue on the Dash 1 Amendment, Mr. Chair, although we have received a minimal fiscal no revenue on the straight bill, which shouldn't change.
And I apologize, the other was not on my list until I just wrote it. The other chief sponsor of the bill is Representative Reed. Do you want to testify from down there? Do you want to testify from up here?
I think, Mr. Chair, I could let these fine gentlemen go forward and see if there's anything that needs to be added, which I doubt.
Okay. Representative Holvey, good morning.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, and committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 4150, which is about the Credit Enhancement Fund. You're probably familiar with that fund, having discussed a previous bill of 4040, I believe, the Investment Act. And this bill plays nicely with that concept as well. It is really about putting some money on the streets for businesses to utilize in the form of loans. The Credit Enhancement Fund is a loan guarantee program that uses some monies from the federal government to help businesses. Currently, we have some definition issues in our statutes that restrict which businesses are eligible for those loan guarantee type of funds. This bill expands the definition of the businesses that are eligible to that. Right now, one of the businesses that are businesses that are eligible are in distressed areas. And as we see some of our counties coming out of that designation of distressed areas, there's a lot of opportunities out there that we will miss. And I think it's extremely important that we stay focused on trying to provide access to capital, especially for small business. As you know, they create most of the jobs in Oregon. And this bill is aimed specifically at doing that by making this fund available to a wider spectrum of businesses across the state.
The timing of this is really important. We have funds that will be available to us, and we're concerned, I think you'll hear from Business Oregon, concerned that we may not be able to utilize the funds that are available to us without making some tweaks that this bill does to the definition of those eligible businesses. I do note that I have some gentlemen that will probably be able to answer a lot more specific questions about how this fund works. It is, again, it's just a loan guarantee for helping banks lend money to businesses, and that is something I think that we're all interested in doing and trying to get Oregon's economy back on the move and keeping that momentum going as we're seeing hopefully our economy improving. With that, I'm going to turn it over to the gentleman beside me that will explain more about this bill. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Transportation Economic Development Committee.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, for the record, my name is John Saris, and I'm the Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. Representative Holvey did a great job explaining what the program does, and quite honestly, if you have direct questions about the program, happy to answer those. Really kind of going back a little bit in time, since 2009, most of the state of Oregon has been designated a distressed area. With this particular program, it allowed us to provide loan guarantees on term loans and lines of credit to companies that were not traded sectors, so retail and service-related companies. As Representative Holvey indicated, as the distressed areas are our counties are coming off of those distressed area designations, some of those opportunities are going away, and basically this temporary provision would allow us to continue to make those guarantees to these other traded or non-traded sector companies for a couple of years as we see how the businesses tend to recover. We do have Larry Goodrow here with us from Columbia Bank to give you an idea of how they use the program and how they implement it and answer any questions there. And if there are any programmatic questions, certainly happy to answer those for you.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Betts, my name is Larry Goodrow with Columbia Bank, as stated. You know, 2008, 2009, and to a lesser extent, 2010 and 2011, have just seen a tremendous deterioration in the financial condition of many of Oregon's small businesses. You know, many of the metrics that banks use to underwrite and approve credit, equity, collateral, cash flow, are continue to be stressed. The companies that have made the really difficult decisions that are still in business have exhausted many of their own resources. The use of the Credit Enhancement Fund allows financial institutions it allows us to do several things: ease the cash flow burden by extending amortization and maturity periods of the loans, thereby reducing the required monthly debt payment. It also allows us, in most cases, in a lot of cases, by using a guarantee, it allows us to keep interest rates relatively low, in fact, sometimes lower than with traditional loans. And also, the guarantee allows collateral advance rates to be higher. So our use of the program is to continue to underwrite good, strong credit. Companies, like I said, that have made the very difficult decisions that have been needed to be made to survive in this economy. But it gives us the tools to lend more. And as we've seen certain counties improve or come off the distressed rolls, it has eliminated some of the some of the companies that we can that we're allowed to make these programs available to, and so I was just here to support this bill and also to answer any questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment and a question. I think this is obviously a good bill. I've put my name on it. I think it's complementary to the Investment Act, which I hope we'll act on soon. But it really is consistent with what we heard around the state as we developed the Investment Act, that businesses want and need this program, and we heard again and again how impressive it's been in terms of the leverage and how it's allowed a great, a much larger amount of money to get into the hands of job creators. Recognize that it's a temporary provision we're considering here to respond to the current economic conditions around the state. And I also, John, wonder if you could talk about some of the opportunities that are presented by the federal action recently.
Chairs, Representative Reed, members of the committee. As Representative Reed indicated, in August of last year, the state of Oregon was approved to receive $16.5 million from the U.S. Department of Treasury. $10 million of those funds was dedicated to capitalizing the Credit Enhancement Fund. One of the obligations that the state has to meet with the U.S. Department of Treasury is to leverage those funds 10 to 1. So for every dollar of public money or federal money that we have, we need to leverage $10 of private lending or essentially bank and credit union lending, if you will. So these funds are going to help us meet those leverage requirements by the end of 2016 and hopefully retain all of those funds within the state and capitalize the program.
Thank you.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I don't know who of you can answer this, but the request for this is because, as stated in testimony, is that we're finding counties are coming off distressed rolls, and this is specifically targeted to that. At least that's what you said. My understanding is it says right here that it's opening this up to every non-traded sector business, and the way I understand that is that's everyone. That's every single business. That's huge. That's broad. I wasn't around here when this credit enhancement fund was created, but I'm assuming it was limited to traded sector, because in my experience, and it's been proven out through evidence after evidence, is that traded sector businesses, for every one traded sector business, there are two, every traded sector job, there are two other jobs as well. So my assumption is that it was passed to incentivize traded sector businesses and jobs so that the rest will follow naturally. I'm assuming that this kicks the anthill and does not assist the traded sector jobs, and in fact competes with dollars that are going to traded sector jobs. So that's what I'm trying to wrap my brain around, is that I assume we don't want to compete with traded sector, we want to incentivize traded sector, and that this would ruin that.
Chairs, Representative Lindsay, one thing I would note is that currently, we have all but four counties are distressed. In those four counties, we have the ability to make these loan guarantees to both traded sector and non-traded sector companies. What this specific bill would allow us to continue that opportunity for about the next year and a half and continue to assist these businesses that don't necessarily meet the traded sector requirements. One of the things, and obviously I wasn't a member of the agency or when the bill was introduced in 1991, excuse me, but one of the possible reasons that traded sector was limited was because of the amount of capitalization that was provided to the program. Originally, the program was seeded with about $6 million of lottery bonded funds. Over the period of time from 1991 to 2009, those funds actually grew from about $6 or $7 million to $12 million. So the program's grown. Actually, in 2009, we were looking at expanding some of the definitions that were out there because we had unmet demand. We had more resources in reserve that weren't necessarily being used. And unfortunately, we had some sweeps that occurred as balanced legislative efforts were balancing budgets. The infusion of these federal dollars has allowed us to once again take a look at how our portfolio is balanced and measured. Right now, what we are seeing is that roughly 30% of the applications that we are seeing coming in are representative of non-traded sector companies, so retail and service oriented. 70% of the portfolio still is, by its very nature, supporting the traded sector activities. And because the primary efforts for this program are operating capital, so your loans, lines of credit that help support business needs,
we have a niche, if you will, for that, and that is steering us more towards traded sector. We don't compete with other guarantee programs that are out there with the federal government, USDA, SBA, et cetera. They do a great job filling those term loan needs that banks traditionally have. Where the emphasis for this program has been over the last decade anyway has really been in the operating capital and lines of credit.
Follow-up.
Please.
So is it more accurate to say that the purpose of this is to be able to open up those funds and exhaust those funds rather than just focusing on the distressed counties? If so, let's just say that. If not, wouldn't it be better just to limit this to those counties that have come off distress rolls or to exclude the four counties that are not distressed?
I think the opportunity here is to continue to help businesses and leverage these funds that we have from the federal government. We have a limited period of time to get to this 10-to-1 leverage ratio. Continuing to expand the program should not put the program in jeopardy, at least through the temporary period that we would have this provision in place. The other thing is that while we have four counties today, we also have three counties that are in phase, which means that they are scheduled to come out of this distressed area designation. So in essence, close to a quarter of the state geographically is going to now be removed from this potential provision. And there are more counties that will continue to enter into phase. And the economic indicators that determine whether or not a county is distressed are primarily the unemployment rates. They are the average wages in the area, and also the foreclosure rates. Those are a couple of the main indicators. Those things don't necessarily translate at the same time to the balance sheets of these companies that need the additional assistance to get operating capital. And the lenders, Larry may be able to speak a little bit more to how there's going to be probably a lag to these balance sheets and other factors that underwriters need to look at when they're trying to extend credit.
And I guess, Representative Lindsay, I would also add that, especially in the smaller counties, many of the businesses that we're dealing with are not necessarily traded sector, but they are companies that provide family wage jobs. They provide a level of employment. And one of the criteria of this program, one of the criteria of the program is that there is either job creation or job savings that go along with granting the guarantee, and it's spoken
that.
To. Yes.
So I see a question from Representative Smith, and then we've really got to move on to the next bill, Representative Smith.
Just to be clear, and either Representative Holvey or John or anybody. To be clear, eligibility doesn't equate with equal or blind treatment, I would assume, so that we would still be allowed to preference traded sector companies in choices where that was appropriate and possible. Is that still accurate?
Representative Smith, yes, that is accurate.
Thanks.
Okay. Appreciate y'all being here. Thanks for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you very much. I urge you to pass it.
Those are the only folks who have signed up to testify on that bill, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4150 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4031. Since we did hear this bill during part of our January hearing, so we heard from some proponents at that, so I think it makes sense to begin with some, kind of pick up where we left off and begin with some opponents to the bill. So I'd invite forward to begin Peter Carlson, Brian Cassidy, and Andy Dyke, and invite Patrick to brief us on 4031.
Gotcha. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4031, we've actually heard this issue a couple times during the interim. This is a measure that prohibits an owner of an outdoor advertising sign from removing the sign from a site without first allowing the landowner to purchase a sign in cases where it is no longer conforms to applicable ordinances or as the lease expires or is terminated. It provides that the sign owner is eligible for a relocation credit for a sign sold to the landowner if the sign and permit meet the requirements for motorist information signs outlined in ORS 377-700-840. The measure has an effective date on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. We've received a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact for the measure. There is no amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Great. Good morning. Welcome. Please proceed.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz.
members of the committee. My name is Brian Cassidy. I am with Meadow Outdoor Advertising. We are a third generation family-owned sign business based in the Dalles, Oregon. I am here to speak to you in opposition of House Bill 4031. The goal of this bill is to address perceived inequities between landowners and sign owners in a situation where a sign has become non-conforming due to changes in local sign regulations. It has been our experience that this bill is actually addressing an issue which does not exist. The landowners and the sign owners are in fact on equal footing in a situation where a sign is non-conforming. The sign owner cannot simply pick up his sign and move to the next property owner, create a lease with that property owner, in the same way that the property owner cannot simply rebuild a sign on his own property. Both of them have an incentive to come to an agreement on a lease in a negotiation to renew a lease on a non-conforming sign. What this bill proposes to do is to insert the state in between two business parties in a private business negotiation and favor one party over another by allowing legislating that the property owner has the right to purchase the sign from the sign owner at the end of a lease term. The sign owner does not have the ability to refuse to sell the sign. This constitutes a taking that's legislated by the state and favors one party over another party. I would urge you to oppose House Bill 4031. Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Representative Hunt, Representative Bentz. My name is Peter Carlson from Bend, Oregon. I'm the owner of a third-generation company established in Bend, 1948. My family moved there at that time, purchased an existing sign company. My grandma ran the business in the 50s. My dad ran the business in the 60s. I moved to Bend in 1997 after working in Portland for a long time and purchased his interest in that business. We currently employ 21 people. We're in two businesses. We're in the billboard business. We also manufacture electrical signs and sell those signs to customers all over the Pacific Northwest. We own billboards in Bend, Redmond, Madison, Bryanville, and Lapine. We currently own 50 state permits. These Oregon permits originated in the early 1970s from signs that we owned on state highways at that time. The signs that have these permits met the Lady Bird Johnson Federal Highway Beautification Act criteria, and they also met the Oregon OMIA criteria created in the 70s. We receive these permits, and the permits can't be used anywhere. They can be used in a 100-mile radius of where they are issued. The billboards that our family owned that did not receive permits were purchased at fair market value by the federal government. The federal government did not take these signs from my family. They established a value by looking at what the future earning potential of the signs were, and they paid our business at that time accordingly. It's my opinion this is how assets are bought and sold between businesses. It's not what its replacement value, it's what it's going to earn going forward. And I think it's very difficult to have meaningful contracts if government can pass laws that throw out the contents of any of these agreements between two parties. Carlson Sign maintains 60 ground leases with property owners in Central Oregon. I've never been in a lease negotiation with any of these people. That includes ideas like suggested in House Bill 4031. This is a business deal between private parties, and a lease is usually framed around these ideas. I'll give you an example. We approach a property owner who is typically not in the sign business and explain that I think I can get a permit approved to construct a sign on his property. If we agree, we come to an understanding on term and a payment. The landowner, by nature of the agreement, becomes a business partner of mine and receives a known annual payment. The sign company works to generate a profit margin by performing the following tasks. We invest the money to get the permits. We engineer and build the structure. We employ a salesperson to sell the advertising. We employ a graphic artist to design and create advertising. We employ a sign crew to put the sign up and take it down. We collect the money for the advertising that we sold. We ensure the liability of the sign, the workers' comp for the people who work on the sign. We fight the legal battles to maintain the sign, participate in free speech in Oregon. We pay the permits and renewal fees to the government agency tasked with administering the laws in Oregon. And we pay the annual personal property tax on the structure. I would not enter into a contract after performing all of these tasks and for 10 years and then have and agree to a lease that says I will sell the business at a cost for the steel that it takes to build the sign. I also don't think a property owner would sell me a permanent easement on his land for a price determined by someone else after the term of the lease expires. If either of the parties expected that these contract provisions should be in the agreement, they would ask for them at the beginning of the discussion. You have to recognize that these signs are a business. Would the legislator create a law that forces a McDonald's franchise owner to sell their restaurant at the end of a lease? Or would a law be passed that dictates that the landowner must sell their property for a discounted price because the McDonald's guys thinks he should own the land now? I don't think that's what the legislature does. My business, Carlson Sign, has a value because we deliver a product and we have a reputation for being very honest and straightforward with people for 64 years. I think the business has a strong potential for future earnings. Mm-hmm. And if someone wants to buy that business from me, I'm open to that discussion. I'm also very motivated to perhaps pass this business on to my children. The concept of taking property and giving it to another party for an arbitrary replacement cost is obviously very concerning to me. And I would ask you to not give House Bill 4031 any more of your consideration. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, appreciate you and members of the committee. Excuse me. I am not a billboard owner, so I am speaking today as a private citizen, not even as in my capacity as chairman of Washington County, although I have discussed this with my colleagues and they are in agreement. We've not taken an official position, so these comments are my own. I am very concerned about the precedent that this sets, because as you heard from the previous speakers, it is government interjecting itself into the contract process between two individuals. A lot more is at stake here than just the physical infrastructure of the billboard. As you heard, there's the risk that every business takes when it applies for permits, the uncertainty of whether or not it would get those permits, all of the waiting time that's taken up, and all of those things cannot be recouped in a forced sale, and essentially that's what this bill would require, is a forced sale. In addition to that, from the county's perspective, again speaking for myself, but not the county, but it does affect the county in that it is uncertain whether or not this breaks the cap on the number of billboards. Because if it's required that the owner of a billboard sell that billboard to another, it's presumed that along with that goes the use of the billboard, and not just transferring the use from some other location in. I don't think that's very clear in the bill. I've heard opinions on both sides, but from a county standpoint, that's very important that we know that ahead of time. In addition, I'm also concerned about the about whether or not this violates the Constitution of the United States, both the Fifth Amendment and the takings clauses in the state of Oregon, and Measure 39, which the voters passed handily, which essentially prevented the taking of private property by the government for sale to another private entity. So all of these taken in total lead up, in my mind, to a very bad bill. So I would urge your opposition of the bill.
Can you just make sure you state your name for the record? You may have at the beginning, but...
I'm sorry if I did not. I'm Andy Dyke.
Great. Thank you. If we could be very judicious in our questions, because we have lots of witnesses coming, Representative Sheehan.
Thank you. To the sign owners, the proponents of this measure claim that after the first lease period has expired, that that's used as a negotiation tool to push down the price. Can you comment on whether or not you've ever renewed a lease for less money than the previous lease period?
I renew leases all the time, and in Central Oregon in particular, I've not experienced a situation where a landowner does not get a increase into their lease. The property value in Central Oregon was rising, as we know, as other property values in the state rose. So there was a time period where it was difficult because the property owner's perception of the value of his property was inflated, like everybody's. So it became difficult to keep reasonable prices on leases, but I've never had a situation where it's gone down.
Okay.
Representative Sheehan, I'll basically reiterate what Peter Carlson said. To my knowledge, we have never renewed a lease for a lower rate, and in fact, in situations where we have a non-conforming sign, typically our lease rates are a little higher than they are where we have a conforming sign, because we don't have the opportunity to be able to move our sign.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the landowners again, I'm an attorney. I write contracts day in and day out, and usually get a nice blue pen for the signers of the contract when they sign it. I'm assuming that when you sign those contracts, those lease agreements, that you read them, you understood them, you understood what could possibly happen at the end of the lease, and that you went into these contracts with your eyes wide open. Is that correct? Or do you want to comment on that?
Representative Lindsay, that is correct.
Yeah, I understand what I'm doing when I enter into an agreement with the property owner.
Okay.
Representative Weider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the current OMIA encourage you, if a land user doesn't want to renew his agreement, do they encourage you to take down a sign, or do they offer you any sort of incentive if a landowner wants to terminate his agreement at the end of a lease with you?
Buyer's remorse.
Are there any sort of incentives under the Oregon Motorists or the OMIA regulations, the Motorist Information Act? For non-conforming signs?
Where I have signs, the description non-conforming doesn't really apply to them, except for I probably have less than 10 that might fit into a non-conforming. I mean, we'd have to describe that. So as far as the OMIA, and what it does, if we can't reach an agreement and a sign needs to be removed from a property, then you apply for a relocation credit. So the permit that we own would go into a non-active status with ODOT, and we can then, upon finding a new location, we could utilize that credit in the future. I don't know if that answers your question.
To where I want to go.
And Amy Joyce from ODOT has signed up to testify later on, so she may be able to further questions on that.
Kind of wanting to go to where the sign company had a little power over the landowner in the negotiation process, because there's a limit of 100 miles in that relocation credit. So if they do negotiate down, and your company may not do it, but we've had landowners come up and testify saying that, hey, they've came back and just chopped our rates in half and different things in earlier testimony. So it may not reflect your company, it's other companies, and this body has kind of created the mess by doing the signed credits.
If I could, the process of permitting a new sign is something that's very difficult. It's you have to meet local criteria, state criteria. You have to find a landowner that would like to be in that business with you. And it's not something that you I think if the property owner knew all of those difficulties that I face, their position is as strong or stronger than mine. And it's not something that we like to do. I mean, it's not, I'm going to, you know, if you don't do this, then I'll go to your neighbor. I mean, because it's just, it doesn't work that way. I mean, it can take a long time to identify a property and actually get a sign placed. So it's not something that sign companies like mine, we try not to do that. But we also have a ceiling of it takes, I gave you a list of all the things that I do to make this work and make a profit. So at some point, regardless of who owns the sign, all of those things have to take place and a margin has to exist at the end of the day. And, you know, I think property owners, business people like me understand that. We reach a negotiation that ultimately, you know, works in most cases.
To follow up with one, he kind of prompted a question here.
We are really going to have a tough time getting through the folks that are here, so I think we're going to have to cut it off there. We appreciate three of you being here. Thanks very much. Next up, Casey Gray, Chris Colvin, Jill Gelino. Gelino. Sorry, Jill.
It's Gelino. But I'm answering.
We had a 50-50 chance. Welcome. Please proceed.
Representative Hunt and Bentz, committee members, thank you very much for this opportunity and good morning. My name is Casey Gray. I'm the real estate manager for CBS Outdoor. We operate all over the country, but in particular here in Oregon. CBS Outdoor and its predecessors have been operating in the state of Oregon as an outdoor advertising company for decades. We have lease agreement contracts with private property owners that date back to the 30s. We have proudly upheld the rules of the state's laws and have relied on regulations to legally monitor the entire industry as well as ourselves. Over the years, we have supported increases and changes in permit fees to help the state continue to regulate the industry, and we will continue to do so. And without repeating objections to this bill that have already been discussed, we have one thing of interest. We'd like to know what extra financial burdens will be placed on the state to attempt to regulate billboards if this bill is passed, and also how will that affect the current permit fees. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee. My name is Chris Colvin. I'm the Vice President and General Manager of Lamar Advertising. Approximately 10 years ago, Lamar did not own or operate a single structure within the state. Since then, we've came in and acquired and or built approximately 275 structures within the state. We've also banked 38 permits of various sizes, some of which can be aggregated and relocated across the state to any legal location, or are subject to that 100-mile radius. In such time, we've done so under ODOT's rules and regulations, the current rules and regulations. Also, Lamar takes great pride in the appearance of our structures. We go to great lengths to maintain and our safety regulations. We paint our structures every year, not every structure, but we continually paint these structures on an ongoing basis. As part of my requirements, I hold safety meetings every month. I do field safety checks on my installers and our subcontractors. Again, we go to great lengths to maintain these structures and to make sure that they are safe. Should this bill pass, I would ask you, should these potential 100 or hundreds of new sign owners, will they continue to regulate the safety and maintenance of these structures as well? I would also ask you, would you indemnify Lamar and the other sign companies should someone not maintain the safety of these structures and somebody get hurt or potentially die based off the non-maintenance of these structures? For these reasons and many more, I obviously ask that you oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill, welcome.
Good morning, Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Benson and members of the committee. My name is Jill Gelino. I'm a partner at the Schwabe, Winston & Wyatt Law Firm in Portland, where I specialize in private property rights. And I've represented the sign industry and those in the sign industry for most of my career. For better or for worse, I was one of the 10 people appointed by Governor Kulongowski to the Big Look Task Force in 2006 to look at Oregon's land use system. I'm here today in my capacity as counsel to the Oregon Outdoor Advertising Association. That is a voluntary association of sign industry owners in the state of Oregon, and it includes most of the major players in Oregon. And our membership has determined that it owns 1,300 signs that are regulated on state routes under the Oregon Motorist Information Act, regulated by ODOT. Our rough calculation is that were this bill to pass, 738 of those 1,300 signs would be affected because they are non-conforming. There's a little bit of a dispute about that, because if the definition of non-conforming sign under the current House bill includes changes due to the uniform building code change, then virtually every sign that is owned by any of the members of the OOAA would be subject to this bill. And so from our standpoint, this proposal has potentially far-ranging consequences for our membership, and accordingly, we definitely oppose it. I was asked to comment on a few of the legal concerns that our membership has due to the potential for this bill passing. Some of these have been mentioned, and I'm happy to take more questions, but just briefly, our concerns are as follows. First of all, it's my legal opinion that this would be a taking under the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution and under the Oregon Constitution. As you know, government can take your property for a public purpose, so long as it pays just compensation. The two flaws in this bill are, one, this is not a public purpose. Rather, it's government sort of interfering in already established private transaction. But two, there's no provision for the payment of just compensation. The compensation that has been drafted in the bill is replacement value. That is not legally recognized just compensation in any taking. Second, as Commissioner Dyke just mentioned, this would be violative of Measure 39. All of you know the fuss that happened after the United States Supreme Court said that it was permissible under the U.S. Constitution to take property from one private property owner and transfer it to another. The result of that was that there was a public outcry across the country, and 43 states subsequently passed laws that prohibit or limit that. In Oregon, that was ballot measure 39, which was passed by 67% of the folks here in Oregon. And this bill essentially does that. It mandates the transfer of property interests from the sign owners to the property owners. Thirdly, it's our belief that this would constitute a contract clause violation. There are constitutional protections for parties that enter into contracts, private contracts, and there is restrictions in both the U.S. and state constitution that prohibit interference in those contracts. And some of you may remember that during the last session, I believe that the only veto that the governor made was based on a concern that a law that had been passed would violate the contract clause, and we think that this bill has the same flaw. And then finally, This bill would give rise in Oregon to claims for intentional interference with contract. Virtually every lease between a landowner and a sign owner has provision which allows the sign owner to take the sign down on the expiration of the lease. And this House Bill 4031 would prohibit that from happening. And so that is an intentional interference with contract that has already been created, and we think that that would subject the state of Oregon to liability. So in conclusion, we think that you should have some serious concerns about the bill. Obviously, you've heard some policy reasons why it's not a good idea, but also there are some reasons to be concerned in respect to the lawfulness and constitutionality of it. Thank you very much.
Representative Weider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Government has been very involved in this when we made the sign credits. But from the argument for the taking and everything, what I'm trying to put together is the landowner here. Wouldn't this create more or a larger market or a larger value on the non-conforming signs when now when a lease is up, multiple companies could be bidding to lease that location at the end of a lease? So therefore, the property owner would be able to receive more for his location.
It's not clear to me that that would happen or not. The interesting thing is that the fact that it's non-conforming actually makes both the sign owner and the landowner very compelled to do business together, because if the sign has to be taken down, there's not another place to put it. The problem with what you're proposing is that you're not offering just, I mean, there's a policy reason, but also there's the equity in terms of if that results, it's because you're not allowing the sign owner compensation at the full value. And
I may follow up.
Very briefly.
The landowner, he doesn't have the credit. He would just have the structure, so they can still take the credit and move, 100 miles down the road or wherever they want to and put up another sign. Someone with a relocation credit would have to come in to use that structure again for a sign location the way the Oregon state law is set up right now. Is that not correct?
Well, there's actually a dispute as to whether this would create more permits under the cap, but assuming your interpretation is correct, Representative Wagner, and I believe that that is going to be the interpretation that Ms. Joyce reports back, a really huge downside with what you've just described is that this raises the specter of hundreds of already constructed, unpermitted billboards in the state of Oregon, and I would hope that ODOT, after just moving through what is probably considered a fairly painful period of dealing with billboards without permits during the gap period, that there's the possibility of hundreds of unpermitted signs that would exist now in Oregon because of this. If those new signs have to get relocation credits from somewhere else and they're not available.
There's a cap on them in the state of Oregon, is there not?
Yes, there is, but sadly there's a history of people having signs without permits.
So if we could focus on extremely urgent questions. I see Representative Smith, Representative Sheehan.
And I apologize, Mr. Chair. I have lots of questions. I'll narrow them down. This is a sort of a challenging thing. I hope we have multiple hearings on it over the next several weeks. That was funny to me. My understanding is that the property right would be, I guess I will say I'm less concerned about the constitutionality concerns, because the property right seems to be held by the landowner, contractual right held by the company, and future contracts would be bargained under the shadow of whatever law we pass. The a factual question I want to ask is, before that, the other general concern I have is, and the way I'd break it down, is does the current situation create lockup? Right. Based on what we've already done with sign law and regulation, does it create sort of captured negotiating parties which make the contracting relationships challenging and artificial? And if yes, then what's the best way to address that, to unlock it? What's the best way related to that? What's the best way to set a value? It might be there's a better way than this. My factual question is, do sign companies ever remove or take down non-conforming signs at the termination of their expiration of a lease? I mean, like practically speaking, what are we talking about here? Do they actually go away?
Yes, but it's a handful. I mean, I would say that most of the folks that I work with in this association, they're not in the business of taking down signs. The circumstances that you've heard about are extremely rare, very few and far between.
Okay. All right.
Quick.
Thank you.
Jill, the taking issue and the ballot measure 39, those involve real property.
Yes.
Is a sign real property or is it a fixture?
A fixture can be real property if it's attached. If it's attached to real property. So in Oregon, the precise nature of a billboard is somewhat legally unclear. The case law around the country is that a billboard is a property right entitling the party to recovery of just compensation when it's taken. But, you know, I'm being very accurate with you, and that is an issue that has not been litigated in Oregon.
So we don't know whether it's a fixture or real property here?
Well, it's certainly the position of my clients that it's real property.
Okay. My second question was for Chris. You've testified before the committee before, right? And I think I asked you last time if you could provide the data of renewal rates versus the original lease and to see if the assertion of the proponents of this bill that this was being used as leverage to lower the cost it was really happening. Did you bring that with you, or did you?
I don't, but I can speak from Lamar's standpoint. I mean, we have but one way to make money, and that's for those structures to be in the ground. We take them down. We don't have a way to make money there. So,
but the renewal rate that you charge,
from,
I guess
from the renewal rate, though.
I'll just ask the same question I asked the other guys then, was have you ever negotiated a lease that was less than the previous term?
Since I've been here, no renewal lease that I can think of has ever come down.
Okay.
You know.
Thank you.
Yes.
Can I believe?
Thank all three of you very much.
Thank you,
Jill. Thanks for your service on the Bigelow Task Force. Sorry we didn't adopt more of your recommendations. Seriously. Next panel, I think we can try to fit four up on this panel, and then we'll just have two more following them, and then we'll have wrapped up. Messina Squires, Chris Rich, Robert Green, Steve Berg. Does that chair unattach right there? Perfect. Oh. Thank you, sir, for your willingness to move. If you just set it right there, she'll come right over and grab them. Thank you. In whatever order you'd like.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Hunt and Bence, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of Total Outdoor. I will be very brief since I have brought additional witnesses with me today. I just want to reframe the issue from our perspective that we had a piece of legislation in 2011 during the legislative session. It originally began as a local government preemption bill. There were objections to that. We removed that provision from the bill, and we continue to maintain from our perspective that the current cap on signs will not be altered. There is a cap. The legislature has implemented a myriad of statutes that have resulted in a cap on the number of current signs in the state of Oregon, and we maintain that this bill does not increase that number and does not increase the cap. I want to correct one thing and just point out from our perspective, Andy Dyke, representing himself as a citizen, just testified that he it was unclear whether or not there would be, whether or not a sign company would have to use an additional credit when they put up a new sign. I just want to direct your attention to page 3 of the bill, lines 1 through 7. It's very clearly stipulated in there that when a sign comes down, ODOT will issue a relocation credit to the existing sign owner. We would not, if we were a sign company that took that relocation credit and put a different sign up with the landowner, we would have to then give up another credit. It is not the credit comes with us. It's clear in the bill from my perspective that that's the case. Last legislative session, and also at the end of the legislative session, we heard from the opponents that three issues that I recall. One, does this bill really only affect non-conforming signs? And there was some discussion about that and whether or not it actually was written correctly. We believe with this draft we have corrected that, and I'd be interested to hear ODOT verify that. And then the issue of appraisal valuation during the last legislative session was a large discussion on the committee's part, and today with me are Chris Rich from Perkins Coie, our attorney, and then Robert Green, who is with Integra Realty Resources. He actually appraises and values billboards, has direct experience with it, so we brought him today because I'm clearly not an appraisal property expert. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Rich to further.
Okay. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, Chair Benz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christopher Rich. I'm an attorney with Perkins Coie and here today to provide public testimony in support of House Bill 4031. To the credit of this committee, I think that it is accurate and clear that this is first and foremost a property rights bill. The property rights, the right to display an outdoor advertising sign, starts with a landowner. There are no independent rights that a sign company has to erect and display a sign independent of a contract. It is a property owner's right. And currently, the OMIA, as it is structured, not only provides an incentive, but I might argue even a mandate, that at the termination or expiration of a lease, the sign companies have little option if that landowner does not wish to do business with them for whatever reason, that they really must take those signs down in order to get their relocation credit to go put the same size sign up at a different location. So this is a statutory problem at its core, and it's perpetuated under the current structure that we have right now. So this bill is intended to narrowly address the problem that at termination expiration, the property owner really is in a grossly unequal bargaining position to a sign company. The sign company says, you renew with us, and we're talking about renewal. This is very important. We are not talking about interference with existing lease terms. You renew with us, or we take the sign down. Those really are the only options, and that's what the statute says. Now, to address some of the specific legal issues, because I think that the primary concerns that this committee is going to have is, one, you know, is there a taking issue here? We have done extensive legal research on this, and our firm has determined that this bill, as it's drafted, does not pose a threat to either a U.S. or a state takings claim, because there is no private property taken for a governmental purpose here. Fundamentally. Secondly, there are such things as regulatory takings, where a regulation so diminishes the property value that the property effectively has no further economic value whatsoever. That is not the situation that we have here. So really, the core elements of takings claims, we don't believe, are implicated. Now, let's, for discussion purposes, suppose they might be. Well, there is an antidote to takings, which is just compensation, which I think is the second issue that this committee needs to be concerned about, which is, as the bill is drafted, does it provide just compensation under any assessment, as that term has been used in the case law, for the sign company? And Mr. Green is here, who is a certified appraiser, to testify to that. I don't believe that a lawyer's opinion will carry as much weight, because the way the bill works is that a certified appraiser, applying the criteria that they are required to use in their professional opinion, is going to control. And the question also is replacement cost the right term to put into the statute? So I think those are important questions. Now, a couple other legal points. It is simply incorrect that anything in this bill increases the number of credits under the cap. There is a cap that was established based on the numbers in 1977. Nothing in this bill will increase that cap. Once a sign company leaves, they get their relocation credit. Then there is a sign structure. That sign structure does not authorize outdoor advertising. It is merely a sign structure. Another company, and there's approximately 16 companies in the state of Oregon right now that compete for locations. One of those 16 would have to bring an existing credit under the cap to that location. So it does not increase those numbers. Secondly, also to that point, Measure 39 was one of these anti-kilo bills. Some of you may have suffered through hearings and discussions on that. We have also thought about this question, and I want to be clear. Measure 39 only applies to, and I'll quote, bodies of real private property used as a residence, business establishment, farm, or forest operation. An outdoor advertising sign, by no reasonable stretch of the statutory terms, could be incorporated into a Measure 39 concern. And so we don't believe that that you or the Legislative Council would find that that was an issue. Now, as to the Contracts Clause question, Legislative Council has already examined this issue, and if you look at Section 5, you will note that the effective date of this bill expressly and clearly states that it does not affect contracts that are in effect until as of the adoption. So it only affects prospective contracts. So you would have to have a contract that ends. You would have a nice break. And it is true that sometimes laws come into effect and that parties then need to take that into account as they execute a new contract. That's what we're talking about here. So as far as interference, intentional interference with contractual relations or interference with contracts, first of all, the basic elements of those claims are not satisfied. And even under the federal and the state claims, if the state is acting with a proper purpose, and one of the proper purposes that has been recognized is to try to either break an oligopoly or to break an inequitable situation where this current statute or the current circumstances are that one party is given a significant economic advantage and another party is given less. And in this case, be very clear that the property right that started every sign location at issue here can be extinguished forever if it's a non-conforming use by the current operation of the OMIA. As soon as that sign comes down, the property owner loses all right and diminishes the value of their property because they don't get to erect it again. So this is really, I think, more important than differential fees paid. We are talking about on individual properties around the state. You've heard testimony on this before. Right now, the law promotes loss of use forever, and we're looking to simply put a small amount of equity, pay just compensation, and do that to promote an overall property right bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Which of you want to proceed? Go ahead.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, good morning, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Robert M. Green, G-R-E-E-N-E. I reside at 6311 Southwest Canby Street in Portland, Oregon. I am a real estate appraiser. I am employed by Integra Realty Resources in Portland as the Director of Litigation Support Services. I have been a real estate appraiser for approximately 30 years, first in Michigan, then in Chicago, and for the last 5.5 years in Oregon. In the course of my career, I have appraised in several states and in Europe. I am currently a general certified real estate appraiser in the states of Oregon and Washington. I have been asked by Mr. Chris Daugherty and Mr. Christopher Rich to speak to the committee regarding some of the issues concerning the valuation of billboard properties, especially insofar as they relate to this bill and the value of property after termination of a lease between a billboard operator and a property owner. I hold the professional designations of MAI and SRA. The MAI is awarded by the Appraisal Institute. It's considered the preeminent designation in our profession. It requires more than 350 hours of specialized education, a field review of more than 3,000 hours of field work by MAI-designated members of the Appraisal Institute, passing of a two-day comprehensive examination, and completion of a demonstration appraisal report roughly comparable to a PhD dissertation. I also have a PhD, and I am an adjunct professor in the Portland State University Real Estate Program, where I teach the beginning and advanced real estate appraisal courses for undergraduates and graduate students. Finally, I serve on local and national committees of the Appraisal Institute, including the Comprehensive Examination Panel and the University Relations Panel. I also am the 2012 president of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute.
Mr. Green, we do have your complete testimony in front of us. If you could just summarize, that would be great.
I'm done.
Content from us.
In the course of my career, I have appraised numerous billboard properties. I am familiar with the specialized issues involved in billboard valuation. I have appraised several billboard properties for eminent domain, and I have also reviewed, and I'm familiar with the professional and academic literature regarding this subject. Billboard valuation has some characteristics special to itself. The traditional three approaches are the sales comparison approach, the cost approach, and the income capitalization approach. However, the sales comparison approach is seldom usable in the appraisal of billboards because there are so few sales available of them. The cost approach is not applicable for operating active billboards because the cost of a billboard is relatively small, comparable to the actual income generated. It would be not unusual for a monopole billboard structure with a cost of $100,000 or $200,000 to generate revenue in the order of seven figures. Typically for active billboards, we rely on the income capitalization approach. Issue, however, is that when we estimate that value, we are not estimating sticks and bricks. The value of that property as an active property is created by the ODOT permit that permits it to operate and which is owned and operated by the sign company. Without that permit, the value of the billboard collapses. Perhaps it will be clearer by consideration of an analogy. Taxi cabs in most cities require a permit called a medallion in order to operate as taxis. I was back in Chicago a few months ago. My taxi driver was a West African man who was driving a brand new Sion. It made a terrific taxi cab. It was small, but it was roomy. It was comfortable. I asked him about his car. He told me he had just purchased it for $19,000. I asked him if he also owned his medallion. In fact, only a minority of taxi drivers own their own medallions. Typically, they work for companies that own medallions and hire the drivers and sometimes the cars as well. Oh, yes, he said quite proudly. He had bought his medallion several years ago. It cost him $65,000. He admitted that he had borrowed the money in order to do it. Do you know how much that medallion would cost today? I asked him. And yes, he said, it would be $200,000 or $225,000. I was shocked, but that's the market. There is a limited number of medallions provided by the city, just as there is a limited number of ODOT permits for billboards in Oregon. When my taxi driver bought his new car, he moved his medallion to his new vehicle. If he sells his car, he will not sell the medallion, just as he did not sell his medallion when he bought his new Sion, or he will sell it separately. His new car was worth $19,000, but the car in and of itself was not magically worth more because its owner also owns a medallion. When a sign company no longer leases land for a billboard, there is minimal residual value that attaches to the left-behind billboard. The value of that physical structure was its ability to generate income. Without that permit, there is no such value. If I wanted to estimate at that situation what the fair market value of that property is, it would be the value of the land plus one of three ways to measure the sign: replacement cost, depreciated replacement cost, or salvage value, just selling it for scrap. Therefore, replacement cost or depreciated replacement cost are more appropriate valuation standards in that case. I would like to stress that my understanding of correct valuation procedures is in conformance with generally accepted appraisal practice. The practice of our profession is governed by the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, a set of standards that is enforced in Oregon by the Oregon Appraiser Certification and Licensing Board, ACLB. And the valuation of special properties like billboards has been discussed, analyzed, and explicated in publications of the Appraisal Institute and others. I have read much of that specialized literature, though doubtless not all of it. I am confident that the methodology and analysis I have described is in conformance with generally accepted appraisal practice. Real estate legal theory, as well as the valuation theory on which it is built, states that what we value are the bundle of rights attributable to a particular form of ownership. For example, when you own a dwelling and lease it to another in exchange for rent, you cede to your tenant the right of occupancy, and in exchange you receive the right to receive rent and the reversion. You get the property back after the lease expires. In a similar fashion, in the case of a billboard permit, the lessee obtained a special benefit by virtue of the ODOT permit, the lessee. It's one that the lessor did not have and does not revert to him. Therefore, the value of it does not accrue to him. A similar case might be that of a restaurant owner with a liquor license. When the restaurant owner terminates his lease, the value of that liquor license does not accrue to the property owner. And that concludes my remarks. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Bentz and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to give testimony today. My name is Steve Berg, and I'm here on behalf of Weston Investment and American Property Management. I am here once again to ask you to pass House Bill 4031. Before I read my testimony, I just want to make a comment based upon the earlier testimony from the opposition. They ran through an impressive list of expenses that they incur when they put up a sign. As a landlord and a lessor of office and various commercial properties, we typically do tenant improvements for tenants when they move in. Sometimes the tenants also do improvements. When we do that, we do it with the understanding that over the course of that initial term, we will recoup our expenses that we've incurred and also generate a reasonable profit. We do not base what expenses we're going to put out on the basis of what we might get if we renew them. The value of those improvements are amortized out over the course of that term. So I think that's an important thing to note. Also, the non-conforming uses that are on these properties, such as our own, are grandfathered in, and only the landowner, as a result, loses the sign use when the sign company chooses to move on. They take their sign credit and they go. They leave us with nothing, even if the sign structure is there in the current form that it's in, because we can't get a credit of our own. So this bill would just level the playing field there. So I think those are important. Over the last three legislative sessions, either Mr. Weston or I, on his behalf, have taken the time to come to several hearings and give the same testimony. During each session and at each hearing, We have explained how the current regulation of outdoor advertising signage has created a noticeable inequity for landowners. There is no disputing that an inequity exists, and I've even heard members of this committee acknowledge that the current law has created a monopolistic environment for the sign companies. There is no doubt in our minds that every owner of land in Oregon would support a bill that would provide an opportunity for the landowner to have the sole decision as to when a legal, non-conforming use located on their land would be extinguished. House Bill 4031 accomplishes just that. The question in our minds is, why would the members of this committee choose not to support House Bill 4031 for the landowners of Oregon? Please pass House Bill 4031. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Lindsay, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many signs, literal signs, are we talking about here?
Co-chairs Benson Hunt, you heard Jill Gelino from Schwabe indicate that she believed it was somewhere around 700 or something. There are the total number of existing signs today is 1,560, and we believe between 50% and 60% of the signs would be affected. So our numbers are actually a little higher than the opponents of the bill. So we think probably around 800, 850.
Representative Smith.
Thanks. So I appreciated your analogy to the taxi cab. It's related to experience, which is nice. But it breaks down in an important way. And that is that I can't move, unlike being able to move a medallion to any new car I get, I don't have the same power with a sign credit. That to try to clarify the issues, the value, as I'm understanding it, isn't in having a sign credit. There's lots of sign credits out there, and some companies are trying to get lots of them. The value isn't in the land, generally speaking, although the land has some value. In the land, and the value isn't in the structure, because it's wood, and we can probably redo one of those. It seems to me the value that we're talking about is the ability to put the sign in that spot. And who owns that? Does Clear Channel own it? Does the sign company own it, or does the landowner own it? And that's a fair question. I don't think it's a constitutional question. I don't think that's, but I don't think it's a constitutional question. Your testimony was extraordinarily helpful and persuasive to me. But as a policy question, I hope we do at least take a chance to grapple with that. Who owns the ability, who is the primary holder of the value of the ability to put it in that spot?
I would say that probably the analogy is imperfect, but the medallion is still. I still, for example, my taxi driver in Chicago couldn't go to O'Hare. His medallion permitted him to be in the city limits. So,
nor do I mean to litigate the analogy, but that's. I wanted to clarify the question.
Representative Smith, Christopher Rich, I think it actually is a legal question. Okay. I think that it is a well-established fact that the pre-existing or the non-conforming use right runs exclusively with the land and therefore to the landowner.
Seeing no other questions, we appreciate you all being here. Thank you very much. I had hoped to get through, we have two additional speakers. We got to move one bill today, and we're right up against the line for caucus meetings that are going to be occurring at 10:30. So we're going to have to carry over the remaining two speakers who have signed up on 4031 until tomorrow, because we're back tomorrow morning, which will be very exciting. So at this point, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4031. And open a work session on House Bill 4040. Patrick, you want to bring us up to speed? Colleagues, you all have what looks like a lengthy, complicated, but is actually looks lengthier than it is. Patrick, you want to speak to it, and then maybe Representative Reed?
Chair, I'll just give you a brief update on where we're at. We heard this bill on Monday. At the time, we were discussing a number of amendments. We have in our hands now the Dash 9 amendment, which I believe Representative Reed or the Treasurer's Office can speak to. We also have in hand a fiscal light on this measure, which allows us to move the bill to the Ways and Means Committee, and also a revenue impact statement, Mr. Chair, on the Dash 9s.
Representative Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to have help from the Treasurer's Office if there are things I missed. Dash 9 amendments that are before you represent to the compilation of a number of things. They incorporate some earlier amendments and do a number of fairly simple things. Actually, the bulk of the length of this of the amendment does one very simple thing, which requires board members to submit statements of economic interest. That is bulky because it makes that reference in several places and a lot of associated language. Aside from that, it updates some of the requirements for members of the board, makes sure that that board would reflect the partisan makeup of the legislature, has some additional skill and experience requirements, clarifies some of the relationships between the board and local governments. It removes references to tax incentives and clarifies that the board would come back with a plan and recommendations to the 2013 session, and that the board, the legislature, would need to approve that that plan for the board in order for the board to have the power to do any of it. That's probably a good place to stop with summary and try to answer any questions.
Representative Bentz, any other comment? I think the two of you have had the most time invested in this amendment than the bill. You want to speak to it further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Reed for working to get these additional elements into the bill, which I think add some very positive things to it. And I think it reflects exactly what we've been talking about, so I'm happy with it.
The Treasurer's Office is on hand. You don't necessarily want to testify. You're just willing to answer questions. Is that right?
Do you have any questions?
Okay. Do we have any questions for the Treasurer's Office or for Representative Smith?
It might be a question for Representative Reed. The something we talked about was clarifying in Yes, I do see it in here. Thanks very much.
Great.
Glad we could help.
Oh, but I have another since I have the floor. And that is speaking of the record into our collective memories and to the Treasurer's Office who is here. I think we have jobs on the brain, which is good. I think we also have Steve Jobs on the brain. We sort of think, oh, we're going to do these kind of things so that we'll have a certain kind of company, you know, like my friend Nat Parker who came in and talked about developing an app. But for a lot of the districts of the people, a lot of that's focused in inner downtown Portland, which I like a lot, but it doesn't reflect all of the economic realities for the state. So to the extent when we're analyzing stuff going forward, if we can also be really prioritizing the community banks and those relationships with early stage companies that might be a little more humble and not just in the technology space, I think that's in the minds of the bill co-sponsors. I'm wanting it to also be in the minds of the working groups as they go forward. And I really appreciate the amendments as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, not only is it on the minds of everyone who I think is here, it's also in the bill reflected in the requirements of the prospective members of the board, both in terms of their experience and their geographic backgrounds.
Great. Thank you.
Is the requirement in the bill that someone from East Portland be on this board?
If not, I'm a no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for listening.
Hard no. I didn't even think about that exactly yet.
He just said he loved downtown Portland, so we already have him on the record. But he's good.
Mr. Chair.
Colleagues, seeing no other. Okay.
Move the Dash 9 amendments to House Bill 4040. They are dated February 7th, 2012.
Representative Reed moves the Dash 9 amendments to House Bill 4040, dated February 7th, 2012. Discussion. Any objection to adopting the Dash 9 amendments? Dash 9 amendments are adopted. Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 4040 be reported to the floor for due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Reed moves
as amended, I should have said.
Yeah. Moves House Bill 4040 as amended to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any further discussion?
Thank you.
With a due pass or a no?
Yes, I'm sorry. And when I restated it, I did not say it with a due pass. With a due pass, correct. Okay. Seeing no further discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Lindsay?
Aye.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Reed?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Sheehan?
Excused.
Co-Chair Bentz?
Aye.
And Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye. Motion carries. So I would just note, we're going to be carrying over House Bill 4028. I would note you've been handed out, I believe, the Dash 3 amendments. You also were already previously emailed the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments. Ignore the Dash 1 amendments. There was just a drafting error, so the dash one amendments are you don't need to focus on. The dash two amendments that you emailed out focus on the issue that was raised at our first hearing related to the EMX project in Eugene. The dash three amendments, which you've just been handed, basically flesh out the whole issue around the community college capital construction piece. You'll recall in the testimony we were given an English language version of what those projects look like. This is the LC version of that. The one slight change when they really went through and did the math of all 17 of those projects at each of the community colleges, it actually ended up adding up to only nine, you'll see the number, it's in line 13 on this amendment, a little over $9.6 million instead of $10 million. So that will adjust down the overall amount in the bill and in that section from $10 million to $9.6 million and correspondingly in the bill. So that will be for your reading pleasure. I don't think there's any other content change. The rest of the project's in there. It's still all 17 schools. It's still the same projects fleshed out. But that is for your reading pleasure, and we'll discuss tomorrow. Anything else? So we will carry over the remaining bills that we did not act on today's agenda until our hearing on Thursday, February 9th, 2012. We're adjourned.